How does one from the Chicago area become either a Cubs fan or a White Sox fan? Are you born into it, or is there like a choice?
I think there's a choice. Some people are born into it, but at the end of the day, I think it comes down to like, you like one or the other. I think that if you like to watch a winning team, you like the White Sox. If you're all into like, if you're like nostalgic and oh, like all about Chicago and like the whole thing, then you're probably more of a Cubs fan. So, because you don't watch the Cubs to watch a team that can play baseball well. You just don't.
That's good to know.
That's my opinion. There will be plenty of Cubs fans who will totally disagree with you, but that's mine.
Most likely. Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 66 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. So how has your summer been? My summer involved taking a little road trip down to Chicago where I met a bunch of readers of thematinee.ca, listeners to the Matinee Cast, all of them bloggers and podcasters in their own right, including today's guest. And I was quite happy to find out that the impression that I got of these people by what I had read of their work and what they had said on my own site was a very good indication of who they were, which is to say that they were all great people, including today's guest, who is the writer of All Eyes on the Screen, a site that is based out of Chicago. So we are across a wire to the Windy City, and I do ask you to welcome Kristen Griffin to the show. How are you?
I am great. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to finally have you on. It's taken most of the summer and about a week or two more than I thought.
But, sorry about that.
That's okay. As I said, I'm just happy that you're here. If you want to learn more details about Kristen and the recording of episode 66, check out the Twitter series I call Mike and the Mechanics. You'll find those if you follow my Twitter feed today, today being Tuesday, August 21st, or by searching #MATM66 on Twitter. On episode 66, we'll be discussing The Bourne Legacy. We'll be finding out people's thoughts on the Sight and Sound poll and cracking out a top 5 list about recasting. First, though, we need to learn more about Kristen. This is Know Your Enemy. Do tell, what was the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
First film I remember seeing would probably have to be Toy Story. I don't think anything memorable happened, but I do remember, I believe it was my uncle who took me on Christmas Day. My parents, like my parents weren't big on us going to theaters even as like kids, but he's like, no, we're going to go do something fun. So yeah, it was. I do remember that, but that's all I remember.
And just to make me feel really old, you would have been about how old when you did this?
Oh, well, it depends on like, I think it came out in what, 95? I think I was 6 or 7. So
there it is. Never fails. What was the last film that you saw?
The last film I saw, I just watched I Love You, Man again. Mm. Yes. That movie cracks me up.
I was going through some old posts today on the site, and I went across that one and remembered how much I did enjoy that one. Did you watch it at home, I guess? Or
Yeah, I watched it at home. I actually own it, but I had only seen it like one time before. I think I'd gotten a deal on it at Blockbuster, and I'm like, man, I want to watch this again because I remember cracking up at Jason Segel a lot in it. So I was like, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because you mentioned that, and I think, yeah, like I have a copy as well, and a lot of times I will just get sucked into watching something on TV that I own, but I don't think to just go over to the shelf and put it on.
I know. Yes, that has happened so many times to me.
Yeah, no. And obviously, yeah, like you said, you cracked it up and it cracked you up totally. You know, the one thing that kind of gets me in that, we were talking about this the other night at a friend's place. So there's the moment where they go to the Rush concert, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We were talking about how Rush is just such a dude's band. For that to be the bonding musical thing for them, it's just so damn perfect.
I know. I felt like there were so many good choices made in that movie. And, like, I loved how it was about, you just don't really see many movies about like a guy trying to make like a guy friend. You know, it's always like that romantic comedy thing. And I liked it because it almost felt a little like more realistic, not entirely, but like in the sense of, you know, trying to find a friend. And because like some people, like they can find the right person really easily. But yeah, and this, it was like, you know, best friend. And I really like that about it. So.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I remember I read a newspaper article lately that says like once you get past a certain age, it might have been 30, I don't know what the age was, but it said once you get past a certain age, making new good friends is kind of hard. So that was kind of seemed like what was in play with that movie for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. And he was definitely, Paul Rudd played one of those guys who is like more like girlfriend guys, and I've known guys like that, so I'm like, I know people like that. It just made me laugh.
Yeah, I think you're talking to a guy like that actually. Oh, okay. What's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
Without a doubt, one of the worst films I've ever seen was the first Twilight movie.
Ooh. Now, how did you end up seeing that? Like, you're not a Twihard, are you?
No, okay. Definitely not. I didn't really know anything about it, but I'd heard all this hype about, oh, Twilight's like the next like Harry Potter. It's so good. And I was like, okay. And so like my sister and I were like, you know what? We'll just get it out of the red box, whatever. We watched it. And then after it was over, both of us just looked at each other and were like, this has got to be one of the worst movies either of us have ever seen.
Yeah, you know, like it's crazy because I really like vampires and have since I was really young. And yeah. Even the ones that I wasn't into, like I'll give you, for instance, I wasn't a huge fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show. But the episodes I've seen, they're pretty cool. You know, yeah. just because it doesn't necessarily speak to me directly doesn't mean that it's not really well done.
Sure.
So I thought that even if something like Twilight couldn't speak to me directly, at least it could be a very good vampire movie.
Right.
But oh. No, nope. They weren't very good, were they?
You know what? No, not at all. Like, I mean, it just wasn't good from any perspective. Like, there was no saving grace in the film, at least for me. And, I mean, I had to have seen it. I mean, it's a couple years, like, but I was like, you know what? I felt like I wasted a dollar and an hour and a half of my time. I'll never get back. So
I think that's the thing. Like, I don't know if we, there is something where you can rent DVDs in my supermarket. It's not Redbox specifically, although okay. It is red. But I've always thought, I'm being told actually it is a Redbox. I think you got to really feel ripped off for a dollar.
I don't know. It's not the greatest price, but
no. What's a classic or essential that you have not seen?
So many. It's like, where to begin? There's more I haven't seen than I have seen. You can name one and I wouldn't see it. I never saw Casablanca, but to get away from, like, not a classic, but something like you'd think at least everyone would see one at least once. I've never seen any of the Fast and Furious films at all, which is like not a classic.
I love that you just mentioned Casablanca and Fast and the Furious in the same breath.
I know. I've never seen either. So, but
I see. Yes. Well, okay. We'll stretch the bounds on classic or essential. I guess it's kind of a modern essential. Like the first Fast and Furious is, I think, what, 10 years old now?
Yeah, it's got to be like, yeah.
At least 8 or 9?
Right, yeah, I would say so.
Okay, well, we're in the same boat because believe it or not, I've never seen any of them either.
Yay, not the only one.
No, you're not. No, and like, I do like dumb action sometimes. Like, I'm of course, we're having this conversation the weekend that The Expendables is out and I'm not seeing that.
Me neither.
But, No, I've always been one for big dumb action, like especially when you get into like 90s action. I like movies like The Rock, and I like movies like Con Air. Yeah. So you would think that something like The Fast and the Furious would actually kind of be up my alley.
Yeah, I would think so, but wow, I'm actually surprised.
No. Now let's go two for one here. Going back to Casablanca. you've been interested in it, but never actually pulled the trigger. What's going on there?
You know, there's really not a whole lot to it other than the fact that, like, I mean, I've seen, like, the poster, I've, like, seen the cover, but, you know, I missed out on so many years of movies when I you know, didn't watch or whatever. So, yeah, it's just one of those, like, I hear great things about. I hear it's a classic. I hear you got to see it, but I just haven't, so.
The cool thing about it that I like the most is that it's very, very smartly written. A lot of films from the 40s, especially, and you know, around that era, like early 50s and late 30s, I kind of have trouble getting people that are like closer to your age than mine, because there's, you know, there's, I think there's like 10 years between us, actually.
Yeah.
But I kind of have trouble getting people to really dig into them because I hear that they're too old fashioned. But the thing I like about Casablanca is that the dialogue all really snaps. The whole story just really, really breezes through. It's probably one of those movies that I would hand over, like, if they said, like, give me top five examples of film writing, of, like, of just script.
It's, really?
It's certainly up there. It's one that I'd say, like, yeah, if you ever really wanted to get into classics, I'd say to kind of bump that one up. It's funny, too. There's a lot of great jokes in that movie.
Well, I'm all about, like, good scripts, so to hear that, that definitely makes me want to see it that much more now.
All right, well, there will be a test on that movie in 2 weeks, so I expect
expect
to see it on All Eyes on Cinema. Last but not least, what is a film that for any reason you wish you had made?
You know, like, when I originally, like, thought about that question, I was like, oh, gosh, I have no idea what would I... There's like, a couple things that... like, for different reasons. So sorry, I'm giving you a multi-answer. Part of it is, it's kind of like a film, Dr. Horrible. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love Dr. Horrible. I love everything about it. And I, like, if I could have been a part of something like that, from the actors to the director to the storyline and the fact that it was, like, aired on the web at first and just the whole thing, I absolutely loved it. So, that's definitely one, like, I would have loved to be a part of that set, because there was, like, it wasn't funded. It all came out of, like, Joss Whedon and his, like, brother's pockets. So I thought that was really cool. And then the other movie might sound totally lame, but I actually love the movie Never Been Kissed, because I'm very, very much like the Drew Barrymore character. So, like, she's very dorky and stuff, and I've actually been a fan of her. I've liked a lot of, like, the older movies she's done. So that's actually something I wouldn't have minded, kind of being a fly in the wall there. So,
you know, one. Okay, so first of all, great answer with Dr. Horrible, because the thing I've actually always loved about Dr. Horrible is that it was what Joss and his buddies did while the writer's strike was on.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. Uh-huh.
You know, so that kind of... basically, for love of the game of filmmaking and creating something is really, really inspiring. Because he could have just cooled his heels and waited for the strike to blow over. But he's like, you know, I want to do something with this time. I want to actually create something while we're just all sitting around, you know, waiting for this thing to be settled. So the fact that that was what came of it was...
I love that he put it on the web for free, too. I thought that was just so cool.
Yeah, and crashed his server.
I know. I think it's awesome.
I don't think he counted on that.
It's like those love for, like, the cinema, though. Like, you know that he's not making it for the money at all, and that's what's so cool about it.
That's it. Now, the other thing I gotta say, though, because I've seen Never Been Kissed once or twice, there's always been one thing that's made me laugh about that movie, and that is... spoilers coming up in case you've never seen Never Been Kissed and care. But the very end of the movie, she's on the baseball diamond and she asks for 2 minutes on the clock. There's no clock in baseball.
That's so true.
Why does she?
Oh my gosh. Well, you're such a baseball fan. I think that's cool that you picked that out. So.
That's the one thing I always wondered about that. It's a wonderful idea that, you know, I'm going to go out in the middle of a whole bunch of people and stand for 2 minutes and just wait. That's lovely. That's beautiful. And the fact
do you think they could have brought a clock, maybe?
I guess. Or, you know, they could have just put, like, the time of day clock and turned it into a countdown. But I'm thinking, put her on the basketball court, put her on the football field. Boy, you know, there's every other sport uses a clock except baseball. So that's the one thing I always wondered about. But those are both Great answers.
Thank you. Great
movies and great shows with Dr. Horrible. Well, there's more about Kristen. We'll get a little bit more about you folks in the next section that we call Come Talk to Me. Well, last episode with Corey Attad, we asked people about the Sight and Sound Top 10 list. This is the new canon of the greatest films of all time, as compiled by film critics and programmers and scholars all around. They do it once every 10 years. It was the subject of my In Between Days number 7 podcast from a few weeks ago, where I sat down with Andrew James from row3.com, and we talked about our top 10 films. So if you haven't heard, go back and listen to that, because it was a lot of fun. But I asked people what they thought about just general thoughts, the list in general, specific titles, anything. Sean Kelly from SK on Movies said, "I have no arguments against the quality of the films on the list. However, only about 10 of the 50 films that were made after 1970, only 6 of which were released in my lifetime, which means post-1982. That's why I can't help but think that this list is an example of, quote, old critics voting for old movies, end quote." Like, really, why ignore most of the last 40 years of movies? I don't mean to sound cynical, but hopefully most of these old-time critics will die off in the next decade, and the next list will be more varied. I did think about that as well, Sean, that the newest film is 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I know Kristen just loves.
Oh, so much.
And it's a 44-year-old film. And that was the one thing that got me, too, was that I thought there's no way that you can't tell me that no film made in either the 70s or the 80s, at least, maybe, you know, kind of prove a buffer of something like 20 years, merits discussion in this list. So the fact that they were old. The funny thing, though, is actually this group of critics that compiled this list, they had more critics than ever before, so the age range was wider. There were a lot more younger critics this time around, so who knows? We might have a whole different set next time around in another 10 years, or it might be very more of the same, so we'll have to wait and see. Jessica from the Velvet Cafe in Sweden said, "I find the list more dull than anything else. It's also a sad reminder of how far we have to go in terms of equality. There are barely any female directors there. I don't say that because women are neglected or anything. It's just a reflection of the state of the film industry over the years. It'll take a long time before we get a real change in this. Sadly, I think this kind of canon lists don't make it any easier. They have a persevering effect." They have a preserving effect. "The most interesting thing about the list isn't the compiled end result. I'll much rather look at the ballot from individual directors. I've seen a few of those on the web, and sometimes they really surprise me." Did you see any of those this week? Because they kind of started coming through.
No, I did not.
Okay. It's been kind of cool to see, because there was a director's list as well that actually had a slightly different 10. And also, so to see the directors and the programmers, their individual ballots start coming through, it's been kind of crazy. Like Michael Mann, the guy who made Heat and The Insider and Ali, he voted one of the top 10 films of all time. He voted for Avatar.
Are you serious?
I kid you not. Now, I'm sure he's got a great reason for it, but everybody
who's... It's got to be, like, technologically based.
That's what I got to think, too. But I'm like, really? Okay.
Shocked.
Yeah,
wow.
So what Jess is saying there, so there's that kind of thing. That's what I'm kind of looking forward to, is now that all those ballots have been released this week, actually sitting down and kind of going through and see who voted for what and kind of wondering what director is off their nut. Over on Twitter, Nikhath Zura from Being Norma Jean said it didn't really matter except being another to-watch list. She liked the director's one better. She said it wouldn't affect her feelings towards the movies. She just doesn't really understand the whole best-of thing. That is still, of course, the underlying message, is that to try and create a best-of list with movies in general is pretty much impossible, right?
I would totally agree with that. Yeah. Absolutely.
And finally, Jake Cole. I didn't get a whole lot of feedback on this one. I'm not sure if people just didn't want to listen to the Total Recall episode or what, or they just don't have feelings on this list. Jake Cole from Not Just Movies said, I still prefer the individual ballots to the main one. More room for idiosyncrasies and discoveries. Even so, I think this list, which features more older films than ever, actually feels more hip slash relevant than many of the previous lists. Did you have any thoughts at all on the thing or any of the films they mentioned? Like, as I said, I know you're not a fan of 2001, for instance, but was there any film on there that you looked and you thought, hey, I really want to see that now?
There are so many really good ones on that list that I haven't seen. So I'm curious just because, well, I mean, I haven't even seen like Citizen Kane. And I hear like some people are like, oh, it's such an amazing movie. And then other people are like, you'll be bored out of your mind. It's just some like stupid old critics like movie that they like. So that's still something like I'd like to see at some point. And I've never seen any Hitchcock films either, except I think I might have seen like one. So I know he's had some stuff on there. So there's quite a few films I haven't seen that I would like to, but you know, I don't have a ton of thoughts about that, but yeah, that's basically.
Okay. Well, the one thing I would say then, if, like, given that looking down the list, I'm going to guess if you've seen any of these, you may have seen one or two.
Yeah.
But the one thing I would say is that like, this is very, very much a scholarly list. Like these are all really friggin' highbrow movies. It might actually be doing them a disservice for somebody to say, here are the 10 best movies, go watch. Because you'll sit down with them for the first time and you'll be like, what the hell?
It's hard because, like, you get these major expectations, like, oh, it must be awfully good if it's on this list. But, you know, it's everyone, the idea of good or great, it's so subjective. Everyone defines it differently. Like, even people who, well, especially people who love film, I think, do. So, and then you have to, like, think about when it was made and how it was made and all those things that go into it, so.
Yeah, it's interesting because Jessica, who was talking earlier about, you know, the place of women in film and how this list, of course, doesn't do that any service.
Right.
She this week watched The Rules of the Game, which ranked in at number 4 on this list, and she just kind of shrugged, not really thinking much of it. Now, I saw, because she discussed it afterwards on Twitter, I saw some people who knew the impact of Rules of the Game kind of underlining, well, it's on there for this and it's on there for that, and you got to watch this and you got to watch that. It's kind of that thing. You almost need to like take a class first and then watch the movie.
Yeah.
Which sometimes that's not what you want to do. I'll admit it. Like, as much as I would love to sit there and discuss a film for an hour and a half, then watch it, and then discuss it for another hour and a half afterwards. That's just me and my geeky tendencies. What I would say to you, if you haven't really seen any of these, is I would actually say to start, like start with the 1 and 2. Start with Vertigo.
Okay.
Because it is very cool. It's accessible Hitchcock. It's kind of dark, actually. It's a really dark and kind of screwed up story.
Sounds interesting. I've been interested in wanting to see Vertigo. It's one of those I just haven't. It's like on a list for me to see.
Yeah.
So maybe bump it up the list.
Yeah, and do check out Citizen Kane and try to kind of gloss over some of its old fashionedness. I do think that it's as a story, when you think about it as a media mogul, having just such personal failure, still holds up very, very well. For me, I've got 4 of them that I've never seen. And I think my whole mission is I gotta check these out. I think I finally gotta scratch these off if I'm this close. And this year has been a lot about checking out some older films. So I do hope that to check them out. Most of the rest of the list, it gave me a very long to watch list. There were some surprises on there, some that did not surprise me at all. But my biggest one, to echo kind of what Sean said, is that I was really surprised that nothing from the last 40 years made the list. I thought something should have.
I agree.
There we go. Well, my next question for my next episode, which will be coming back in 2 weeks, is a lot easier than what you think of some snooty top 10 list. I want to know, we're coming up on the fall, if you can believe that shit. I want to know, what fall 2012 movie or movies are you looking forward to the most? Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook. You can leave me a comment on the website, of course. I want to know, this fall, what movie are you looking forward to seeing the most? That takes us to this episode, feature review, the new slang. And the new slang for episode 66 is The Bourne Legacy. The Bourne Legacy was written and directed by Tony Gilroy. It stars Jeremy Renner, Rachel Weisz, and Edward Norton. Much the same that we saw in the previous Bourne trilogy, there is a super soldier-like intelligence agent. This time, his name is Aaron Cross. That's Jeremy Renner. And this movie is set when the events of the Bourne Ultimatum are unfolding. So the program that he's a part of, this program's called Outcome, is being shut down and he's being hunted. So he manages to basically crash into Rachel Weisz, and the two of them are on the run from Outcome and the CIA operatives that are running that program. Kristen, what did you think of the Bourne Legacy?
Oh, I thought many things. I did enjoy the film, but I definitely thought it was lacking like that great thing that all the other Bourne films had. You know, I think it's cool that they're like trying to like make a legacy and a thing out of it, but it didn't have that like that touch. I'm trying to like think of like the specific thing it was missing. I think a lot of it for me, my one like big complaint with it was that there wasn't a strong villain for one. And then the other thing is that the motivation for the main character, it was all just like, I need to get my chems. Like that was like his whole like motivation in it. And that was it. So like it, I don't know. Those are my issues, but I did like, it was an enjoyable action film to like sit down and like just chill and watch though. So I did enjoy it.
Okay. Well, that's good. I think I'm of the same opinion as you. I think about it sometimes. And when I wrote the piece on the Bourne Legacy for my site, I kind of equated it to a party where I'm hanging out with people who I don't normally hang out with in a bar that I wouldn't normally frequent, but I'm having fun anyway. It felt like a lot of pieces were out of place, but I was still, in the end, I still came away enjoying it. And that, like, this kind of stands in stark contrast to the last film we talked about on this show, Total Recall, which was also a film that was very much out of joint, but ultimately left me dissatisfied. This is one where it's messy. Lord, is it ever messy. But I came away from it still feeling like I got my money's worth, if barely.
If barely. Yeah, I would. Yeah, that's a good assessment, I would say. Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, but for me, the action this time felt a little bit more. We are, by the way, just to kind of pause it there, we are going to be talking a lot about the other three films in this series. I don't think you could have this conversation without bringing in the previous Bourne trilogy, because this film, just strictly speaking, this film doesn't exist on its own. It spends the first hour, basically, going over things that like have happened in the other three movies.
Yeah, a lot of it would just seem like, it's like they were really like, it felt like they were working really hard trying to like incorporate the other ones in it as much as possible. It almost felt like they were trying too hard, like a little bit. So
yeah, they bring in, you know, they trot in Scott Glenn for a minute, and then they trot in David Strathairn for a minute, and they trot in. Yep. They keep bringing in the old band for just the briefest of glimpses to basically remind you of everything that's happened before. So this film does not exist on its own.
It does not. And it can't exist on its own at all.
No. And so we have to speak of it. So with that in mind, with the whole Bourne series in mind, I couldn't help but feel that the action this time was a little bit dulled down, that we didn't get the foot chase with Clive Owen. We didn't get the duel by magazine, basically, if you remember that moment from Bourne Supremacy. It all had its volume turned down.
I felt like they were really trying to bring it, but at the same time, like, some of it was like difficult to watch, and I was like, maybe it's just me, but I really think like some of it, like the motorcycle chase scene, I was really excited about it because I thought what they had shown in the trailer, I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. And it's not that it was like bad in the film, but I just felt like there were times when I couldn't see everything going on, or be a little shaky, or the angle just wasn't as good. So I was a little bummed out, and then that scene like went on forever. So I don't know.
Yeah, it certainly did. The director, Tony Gilroy, has not really done much in the way of action films. He directed Michael Clayton and he directed Duplicity, neither of which exactly have huge action set pieces. So it's possible that he was just out of his depth.
I would agree with that because I hear like great things about Michael Clayton. It's a movie on my list to see as
well. Oh yeah, it's fantastic, but it's a fantastic drama. I don't know. That was my biggest kind of like the Bourne legacy. I mentioned this on another show that I was a guest on earlier this week, and that is that the Bourne legacy in the last decade really more or less took over for the James Bond series. Casino Royale was fantastic. Quantum of Solace a little bit less so, and the last Pierce Brosnan one that showed up in 2003 or so also very much less so. So we kind of took a decade off from James Bond, and in its stead we had the Bourne films and their action set pieces. So to have this one come down with very little action, first of all, because most of the first half goes by with not all that much. You know, we get a little scene with a wolf, which was a little action-esque. And then we get around the one-hour mark, we finally get this showdown in this cabin in the woods. So to have that happen was a little bit of a letdown for me.
Yeah, you weren't the only one who felt a little let down. I felt the same as well.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of Jeremy Renner, both in this part and just in general? Because, you know, for me, he was the draw for this movie.
Yeah, he was the draw for me too. I'm a big fan of him. For one, I think he's hot. I mean, he's like 41 and he's like in excellent shape and he just looks great. But like, I feel like he's really is showing up in everything. He, when Mission Impossible 4 came around, like everyone thought, oh, they're setting this one up so that Jeremy Renner will become the next Ethan Hunt. And then he was in the Avengers and we're like, oh, he's Hawkeye. Maybe they'll be making like a Hawkeye movie and starring him because he had that little scene in Thor. And then, you know, heard news about the Bourne legacy and they're like, oh, they're going to set him up as the next Jason Bourne. So part of me feels a little sorry for him because like, he's not really becoming any of these new characters. Like, you know, he's just kind of playing a little bit more supporting roles, but I think like it's nice to see him in like a lead role. I think he's excellent. I know he was in The Hurt Locker, which I have not seen.
Oh, brother.
I know, right?
You're killing me, dude.
Dude, I know. I'm killing myself here with this. I've heard great things about it, but I feel like he's kind of like just coming on the scene a little bit, and, well, like, to be, like, 41 and coming on, like, it's almost like he's fitting right in, though. They're really casting him in a lot of, like, action-related roles, so I'm a little curious to see whether he could do drama or anything like that. But no, I enjoyed him in the film. I thought he was one of the better aspects and like part of the Bourne legacy.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is for me, he, like you said, he's kind of, they're trying to drop him into these franchises and he's not necessarily latching on, but not for anything that he's doing wrong. Mm-hmm. Usually for something that the rest of the franchise is kind of doing. But
right.
Did you see him in The Town?
Yes, I did see him in The Town.
See, and that's the thing I like about him the most is, along with the fact that I believe that he can carry a film, you know, regardless of how good the script is, I think that he's also a really good team player. So when you drop him into these movies like Ghost Protocol and like The Avengers and like The Town, he plays really, really well off everybody else. So you watch him with his chemistry with Ben Affleck in that movie, and it's awesome. Yeah. So seeing that kind of thing, you're right. It's kind of crazy that you've got this movie star showing up on the scene at the age of 41. But I hope that we're just kind of seeing the beginnings of his career because he's done some awesome things.
I feel the same way. I hope to see him in like a ton more. I think he's great.
Yeah. But this movie, it was, I guess I come away liking it just barely, but ultimately dissatisfied. Was there anything that stuck out for you that you wanted to talk about with the movie at all, or?
Well, there was one scene that I thought was just shot so well. Like, it was like the best scene in the film.
Okay.
And Jeremy Renner actually wasn't in it.
Oh, okay.
It was the lab scene, like, where the one guy went on a killing spree and started shooting people.
Right.
I know that sounds a little bit, like, weird and dark, like, oh, that was your favorite scene in the movie. But I just thought it was, like, very intense and just well shot and well done. I really liked it a lot, in the sense that it felt very real and creepy, and I just thought it was interesting how, like, he just came around and, like, these people were screaming and begging him to stop. It felt, like, very... kind of like a terrorist type thing. I don't typically like, oh, I love scenes where people get shot and killed, but I felt like it was very real. Like,
yeah. In that opening hour that I talked about, that I wasn't crazy about that opening hour, that was easily the highlight of that opening.
Yes.
You know, basically setting up the whole thing was just seeing him almost snap, really, because somebody tried to tell me that there is an explanation of what happened and why he did that, but I don't think there was, and that actually
I don't think there was either.
No, that actually for me makes things a little bit more unsettling. I'm usually more disturbed when there is no reason. I think the running line that I was told was he was part of shutting down Outcome and shutting down everything that had to do with it, because they were basically, you know, they were closing down the whole program, including the production of the medicine that would do it. So he was tapped to wipe it out. I don't know that that's really clearly underlined. It's possible that I'm just a dummy and I just
missed it. No, you're not a dummy. It wasn't underlined. I kept thinking, oh, that must have been what he was supposed to do. But they never really fully explained it and brought it around and was like, I don't know. And I think it's better to, like, to see than to tell, but at the same time they didn't like explain that too well.
Yeah. So if that is the case, then I wouldn't mind seeing just one more line. I've spent half this summer filling in blanks where everybody else has screamed plot hole. So I think this is my chance. If you know, for everybody who's cried at me about plot holes, this is the one that I'm going to point to of somebody explain this to me. And if you're listening and you know the answer, do let me know, because I would like to know that.
I'd like to know as well. Yeah.
But that said, even just without explanation, it's an awesome scene. So you're right.
Yeah, it just, everything about it felt so real. And I was like, wow, this is like not what I was expecting in a Bourne movie at all. So I was a little taken off guard, but in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So we like to end the reviews with the souvenir. The one thing that if you could take from the movie for any rhyme or reason, the one thing that you would keep. Was there something you saw in this movie that you liked that you would want to keep with you as a souvenir from the Bourne legacy?
I don't know if this sounds really lame, but probably just Jeremy Renner with his shirt off. Like, he was shirtless in it twice, and that was, like, enough for me to be like, yeah, this was worth going to.
Okay.
I'm a fan.
That's all right. For me, I know some other people are kind of sick of it, but it's the one thing actually I do like is the song that I used that got us into this segment of the podcast, Extreme Ways by Moby. It has ended off every Bourne film so far. And to hear those notes scream out at the end of the movie again, it always gives me a smile. It has every time that they've used that to close out a Bourne film.
That was a great scene, and I did enjoy that ending. It very much had the feel of a Bourne movie, and then that song just brings it like full circle.
Yeah, so that's my souvenir. Well, Kristen, we rate these movies on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So what would you give the Bourne legacy?
Well, for the film itself,
yep.
I would probably give it 2 stars.
Yeah, okay, so pretty much right on the line. I'm going to give it 2.5 just because, as I said, it sounds like I liked it just a little bit more than you. And as I said, I ultimately did have fun with it. And though I say I had fun with it despite myself, the one thing I take away from it the most is that I hope there are more Aaron Cross movies. I don't know that we're going to get them because I don't think that this movie performed nearly well enough to get another movie greenlit. So we'll see.
We'll have to see, because I thought I had heard a rumor, but it was just a rumor that if they did make a fifth, that they were going to try to get Matt Damon to come back as well and have both Matt Damon and Jeremy Renner. So I tend to wonder.
That would be cool.
That would be cool.
Well, there we go. Let us know what you thought of the Bourne legacy. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook, anywhere really. You can use the comment section of the blog, of course. And maybe you think we're both crazy. Maybe you loved it. Maybe you hated it. Yeah. Let me know. And we'll be right back after one more break with the top five list, the best of you. The Bourne films, of course, handed off the torchbearer of the series from Matt Damon to Jeremy Renner. There wasn't a complete recasting, but it might as well have seemed that way. So Kristen and I kind of put our heads together and thought about other instances where a film handed off the grunt work to another actor and put together our list of top five moments of recasting. And are yours in any kind of order, or just they're just kind of the order that you thought of them?
They're the order I thought of them in. Okay. They're not in any specific order.
Same with mine. Mine aren't really in an order at all. So we're just going to kind of go down this list one by one. So what is your first instance of great recasting?
Well, there's one actually that I don't know if I'm like breaking the rule here, but I love the Aladdin movies growing up, and Dan Castellaneta, if I pronounced that correctly, he replaced Robin Williams as the genie in The Return of Jafar, but then Robin Williams came back for, like, the third one, and I thought he did a great job for what he had to work with, because I thought Williams did just, like, a fantastic job voicing the genie. Like, I got, like, flashbacks to seeing Mrs. Doubtfire with him, like, in the beginning of the movie, voicing an animated character. And I think I think his voice is such a strong thing for him, but I still thought that Dan, he did a great job replacing him, even if it was just for the one film.
Yeah. It's funny. Cause first of all, people forget that there were other Aladdin movies. Let's start there. But people also forget that Robin Williams got into a fight with Disney and didn't come back. So, you know, hearing the dude who's Homer Simpson, basically. come in and do his best genie. That was pretty crazy. And you thought he held his own? You thought he kind of...
I did. Well, like, what he had to work with. I mean, I think that those are actually large shoes to fill for that character, because Williams was such a, like, a fun, cool, strong, like, voice for that character. So, but I thought that he did, you know, he did as much as he could with the role. And I think Return of Jafar is actually one of the better animated sequels out there. So that might just be me, but yeah.
Not bad. Not bad at all. Well, my first one goes back a little ways, and it's one that people kind of forget about. My first one is Harrison Ford as Jack Ryan. Jack Ryan first showed up on screen in The Hunt for Red October, and this is when he was played by a much more svelte Alec Baldwin. In that movie, it's kind of crazy because Jack Ryan wasn't even really the main crux of the movie. It was very much Sean Connery's show, and yes, Alec Baldwin just happened to be along for the ride. So the thing is, in those books, in the Tom Clancy books, Ryan, of course, is a much bigger character. So when they decided to make more movies, when they decided to make Clear and Present Danger, and certainly when they decided to make Patriot Games, which is the first instance of the recasting, they thought they needed to go with somebody a little bit better, and they dropped in Harrison Ford. So... Oh.
Harrison Ford, he can't do very much wrong, if any.
No, he cannot. So seeing him take over this very, very popular book series on the silver screen was really, really quite something. Patriot Games was, of course, the first one where he was Jack Ryan. And it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here, because, first of all, Jack Ryan has already been recast once. They tried dropping Ben Affleck into the role for The Sum of All Fears back in 2002. And that didn't really go so well.
I think he's better behind the camera.
Yes. Yes. Strangely enough, you know, if you had told me Ben Affleck is going to be a great director, I probably wouldn't have believed you. But it turns out.
He's pretty good.
Yeah, he's got some things. And they're actually going to try starting over, because now going forward, Chris Pine is going to be Jack Ryan in an upcoming movie. Oh yeah, but I think I think that Harrison Ford is the benchmark to try and hit, and I don't know that Chris Pine.
I don't know if like I've liked Chris Pine and what I've seen him in. I think he has a lot of potential, but Harrison Ford's shoes, I don't know how, those are hard, very, very large shoes to fill. So
you got it. You got it. So there we go. So for the, I think, unless I'm counting wrong, the four Jack Ryan movies so far, Harrison Ford has done the best job. Certainly did a lot better than Alec Baldwin in The Hunt for Red October.
Yep.
So who's your next moment of great recasting?
I know this one. This one's a really popular one. Like, when you think of the idea of recasting, I think a lot of people automatically think of this one because it's definitely a more recent film. But I love the recasting of Maggie Gyllenhaal for in place of Katie Holmes as Rachel Dawes in The Dark Knight. I thought it was a great recasting. You know, a lot of people tell me, like, oh, Katie Holmes was so much better. And, yeah, I disagree. I thought Gyllenhaal just came in and totally took the role and did a great job. And, you know, of course they killed her off, so they wouldn't have to continue dealing with the character. But I'm a big fan of Maggie Gyllenhaal. I think she's great. I think Katie Holmes is annoying. Like, even though I thought Katie Holmes did a great job in Batman Begins, but, like, she, like, I don't know if it was because I don't remember the reason she didn't come back. I think she just, like, took a break from acting and stuff and had a kid, but...
We were trying to figure that out during the podcast trilogy where we were talking about all three Batman films, and this moment did come up, the discussion of Katie Holmes to Maggie Gyllenhaal. We couldn't come up with a definitive answer. The interweb failed us in terms of documenting what the actual reason was. We couldn't find out if she quit or she was fired or what happened. But yeah, I'm with you. I thought that this was a major step up. I thought that there were some heavy hitters. There's some heavy hitters in Batman Begins, period. But yeah, also in The Dark Knight. And I really think that Katie Holmes would have been, like, deeply, deeply overmatched. And
I would agree so much.
Yeah, and that I don't know, given the fate of Rachel Dawes, I don't know that it would have had the impact that it had when Maggie Gyllenhaal played it.
You know, I don't think it would have if Katie Holmes had been the one doing it, because I don't really think she has the capacity to bring that kind of intensity and drama to a role. I really don't. I've never really been a whole lot impressed with her acting. Not that I think she's, like, bad. I just don't think she just doesn't have the it factor at all, in my opinion.
No,
as an actress. So
that was definitely a good choice, and definitely one that that I agree wholeheartedly with, for sure.
Yay! I bet so many people disagree with me and
really?
Be like, oh yeah, like, a lot of friends are all like, Katie Holmes was so much better, and I'm like, you're out of your mind, whatever.
Oh,
but
Lordy.
Yeah.
some people. There's just no accounting for taste.
I know.
Well, my next one is very recent, actually, and it comes from this summer. It is something I certainly did not expect to like as much as I did. The idea to drop in Mark Ruffalo as the Incredible Hulk in the Avengers. So here, first of all, we have a part that has been done by two other actors so far, by Eric Bana and by Ed Norton. And then in this movie now, we're going to give it over to a whole different actor and basically completely break continuity with this character and make it an uphill climb. So first of all, within the film itself, the idea that the Hulk is one of the most interesting pieces is amazing, because he seems like, on paper, he seems like the dullest character in the whole wide world.
Right.
Also, then, so beyond just making him interesting within the scope of this movie, to get an actor finally to play him in a way that actually engages the audience the way Mark Ruffalo does with both the Hulk and Bruce Banner was so unexpected and so fantastic that you just can't help but sit back and wonder, how did he not get the part in the first place?
No kidding. I think Mark Ruffalo is one of those extremely underrated actors out there. I liked him in everything I've seen him in, and I've seen him in a lot of films just because I like him so much. So I, like, completely agree. He killed Ed Norton. Like, thank God they didn't put him in the film. Like, I thought Mark Ruffalo was such a fantastic Hulk. I really liked him.
Yeah. The funny thing about him was the main difference between him and Norton And we kind of saw this with, certainly with the Bourne legacy, because we didn't even really talk about Ed Norton, because he's a non-factor in that movie, he doesn't really know how to have fun. He had some fun in Moonrise Kingdom, but by and large, it feels like he's taking himself too seriously. So
yep.
I don't know that, I think that's the thing. He wouldn't have worked all that well in this movie, and Mark Ruffalo is certainly a much better choice.
And I even wanted to throw in about that. I remember reading that when he was in the Hulk, he like demanded a lot of changes to the script.
Oh yeah.
So he was a bit of a, high maintenance person to deal with, I think, with that.
He does not play well with others, we shall say.
No, literally.
No. Well, there we go. Mark Ruffalo is the Incredible Hulk. That's my next one. So what's your next choice of great recasting?
I thought it was a great recast to have, and this was, it's actually like right along that Avengers, talking about them, Don Cheadle replacing Terrence Howard as Jim Rhodes in Iron Man 2. I thought it was a good change, partly because I don't think Terrence Howard, I thought he was good in it, but I heard he got actually a higher paycheck than Robert Downey Jr. in the first Iron Man. And wow. Yeah, so he was kind of, and it seems like another one of those high maintenance deals. And so, yeah, they didn't really ask him to come back, but I like Don Cheadle. I think he's so great at doing, whether it's comedy or drama, I just think he's good in whatever he does. And I thought he was a good, supporting character in Iron Man 2. So I, look forward and hope he'll be in Iron Man 3 as well.
See, I like Terrence Howard. But I don't know what I don't really know what he would have brought to Iron Man 2, because Iron Man 2, of course, Rhodey's role in the whole thing gets a lot bigger because he's got to step in and be War Machine, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know how well he would have pulled off the more intense action parts of the story.
Yeah, I think it's one of those roles. It's not like, oh, like, this is such an important role, blah, blah, blah. But, like, for me, it's just more like, I like Don Cheadle. I think he's a good actor. So I was happy to see him in the film, and I thought he did a nice job.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, definitely. My next one to move along here is a little bit of a layup and a little bit of a cheat, but my next one is Daniel Craig as 007. James Bond, of course, has been replaced many times over the course of the years, and in some ways is kind of just an example of what you want to do with a series. You don't necessarily want to reboot or restart or reload or any of that crap. Just mm-hmm. keep on carrying along and just drop new actors in, and we'll pick up the pieces. We've done that with James Bond for 50 years now. So Craig, I say, is up there as one of the very best Bonds. The only thing that is holding him back at the moment is just lack of outings. He's only been James Bond in two movies, and one of those wasn't so hot. I look forward to him in Skyfall. It's hard to say what exactly it is he brings that differs him from everybody else. The thing I think is he's got a little bit more gravity to him. The others I always kind of felt were playing a cartoon. He seems to be taking it just a little bit more seriously.
I would totally agree. I think the tone of those movies in general are more like serious too, but he really does. He has a good intensity to him, and he just, everything about, I think, Daniel Craig, at least to me, seeing him on screen, he has it so together. He has everything together with himself, and I think that fits really well for that James Bond character. So I think he does a nice job as well. I think he was a good person to put in there, so I think he does great.
Yeah. It was funny for me because I did like Pierce Brosnan quite a bit.
Yes.
I love GoldenEye, and I love Tomorrow Never Dies. The other two, not quite as much, but I did like them quite a bit. So to see somebody else come in after him and do the role really, really well, I was very surprised. I look for it. I hope that now that all of MGM's legal troubles are behind them, that they can make a few more James Bonds with him in the role before he has got to pass it over to somebody else for all sorts of reasons. Daniel Craig, definitely a great bit of recasting. Just the regular line of recasting that happens with James Bond. Once a decade or so, we get a new guy, and it's always, well, how's the new guy? And in terms of Daniel Craig, it was great.
Yep, I would agree with you.
All right, your turn. Who's your next actor?
This next one, it's such a small role, and it's not a huge difference, but I'm a big fan of the Back to the Future films. I love them. And Elizabeth Shue actually replaced Claudia Wells as Jennifer Parker, and that role isn't big, but it's the person who played Marty's girlfriend in it. And it's not like a huge change, like not a life-changing deal, but, you know, Elizabeth Shue, I think, was a little bit sexier. She did the role. Like, I think she brought something a little different to it. It was a subtle change, but I felt like it worked. I thought she did a good job. So I actually don't have a lot to say about that, but it's something I noticed because I'm a big fan of the Back to the Future series. So, yeah, that's my...
Well, I've got one for you on that respect. I first saw Back... I basically caught up with the trilogy kind of smack in the middle of it. I didn't see the first one until right before the second one. So around 1989. And then, of course, the third one came out the next summer in 1990. Mm-hmm. So I kind of saw them all within the span of 6 months or so. And the funniest thing is, so after seeing them all, or like from 1989 to 1990, I think it then took me 12 years or 13 years to realize that they'd changed the actress.
It's really subtle, isn't it? Not
very. Yeah, so it was, I don't know if it was just how little attention I was paying to Jennifer Parker or how similar the two actresses seemed to 12-year-old me.
It is a small role too, so.
Yeah, or just how small the part is. But I felt so friggin' dumb when I realized not only that they changed the part, but that I knew Elizabeth Shue at the time and I didn't catch that.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's definitely subtle, but I thought it was, like, you know, I don't know the reasoning behind it, but, you know, I don't know if, like, maybe Wells just couldn't come back, but I thought, like, she did a good job just coming in, so.
Yeah. Yep. No, that was a good one. My next one is me bending the rules again, and I don't know how much you'll have to say on this one, because I'm going to take a running guess that you actually haven't seen this movie.
Okay, then.
Okay, so first of all, it happens in The Godfather 2.
No, I have not.
Okay, so there, yeah, so as I said, as I surmised. And to my point that it's a cheat, it's not exactly recasting. It's just a different actor in the same role. So in The Godfather Part 1, of course, you have Marlon Brando as Vito Corleone, the Godfather who the movie is named after.
Yeah.
In Part 2, we learn about his origins. We learn about him coming to New York and, you know, establishing himself as a force to be reckoned with on the crime scene and a person who commands great respect. And that whole story has him being played by Robert De Niro.
That's kind of weird. Wow.
Yeah. It was just, even at the time, it was kind of a daring choice to make, because you had this very iconic part in what Marlon Brando had done. It was an Oscar winning part.
Yeah. And you, absolutely.
You hand it over to another actor and you almost directly tell him, don't imitate the role. You want to go out there and you want to honor the role. You want to have little traces of it in them. Like, there's little, I'm doing them. You can't even see, of course, because this is audio, but there's little like gestures that Brando did that you see De Niro do every once in a while.
And that's just kind of annoying if he's imitating him then.
Yeah, exactly. It turns into cartoon. So, yeah. So to see him do that and to see him, you know, carry himself in a way that helps him rise up in this neighborhood and become a very respected and very, very powerful man in this neighborhood, and to draw it all from what we see in The Godfather, because what we see in The Godfather is a man who's very, very much in his decline. He's very old. He, within the span of The Godfather, he gets shot. Like, he gets basically taken down almost entirely. So to see him in this whole other capacity on his way up is really, really something cool.
Very cool. I will obviously have to see them, but yeah. I've seen like the first 20 minutes of the first Godfather film and that's it. So,
which you didn't even get out of the wedding, did you?
No, not even out of the wedding. I did find it entertaining what I did see. I had to return it to the library, but I was like, man, I bet this was like really good. So yeah.
No, and the funny thing is, you know, it's a long, the wedding is a long scene, as most Italian weddings are. And I speak from experience. So, all right, you got one more. Who is your last bit of great recasting?
Well, it's unfortunate with this recasting because the person died, but I've seen all the Harry Potter films, and Richard Harris passed, and so obviously they still need to fill the role, and they had Michael Gambon come in. And I totally preferred Michael Gambon to Richard Harris. Richard Harris was a little bit of a bore, and he just seemed very tired on the screen, and maybe that's because he was really old and close to his time. I'm not sure. But I just, like, enjoyed Michael Gambon's performance a lot better in the last, what was it, like, six movies. Yeah. So I thought he did a really good job. I felt like he took over the role, and he kind of gave it his own thing a little bit, but at the same time, I felt like he very much honored the character and the character that was written in the book. So I enjoyed him.
The thing I've always thought, first of all, it's you're right. It's unfortunate that this recasting had to happen because it involved somebody passing away. But the one thing I was always curious about is what we would have seen from Richard Harris in those other movies had he not. And I think it would have been a very, very, very different take. The thing that Gambon seemed to bring that Harris never had was this kind of underlying anger. He's always very peaceful, and he's always very gentle, but when things start getting real in that world, he has a way of flipping a switch that makes you see that you are not going to trifle with this person, whether mm-hmm. you are a student or a teacher or you're somebody who's on the other side of this whole conflict. You see in him this flash of power, really.
Yeah, there was definitely intimidation in him that there was
that I never saw in Harris in those first two movies. The weird thing of the Harris Gambon debate is that Harris gets kind of the lightest two chapters, like from the part three onward, yes, is when things start getting very heavy and very dark. So even if that anger and that heaviness exists within Harris's performance, it doesn't suit his chapters. So we'll never really know what it was that he might have brought. All right, well, my last one, and this, again, might seem like a cheat, but it's my show, so I'm taking it. Through the entire scope that we've seen on television and in the movies, we have seen many, many, many iterations of the character of the Joker. And I think that it stands to reason that the version done by Heath Ledger has become the most iconic, and possibly now the benchmark that needs to be eclipsed. With the history I have with the Batman series, I watched the campy 60s TV show, and there was the movie, of course, and the first film, the Tim Burton film, came out right when I was of the right age, and seeing the Joker turn from that clown that Cesar Romero played him as in the movies and in the TV show and on the movie to this killer, this cold-blooded killer, this insane killer, really, that Jack Nicholson turned him into, was already a hard shift enough. To see it go further and see what Heath Ledger did to turn him into not just an insane killer, but just lunacy personified, was something altogether different and will be very, very hard to top. And that's, I think, kind of the key that I was going for with this whole list of,
that's a great one to end on.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing of, if you're going to bring somebody else into a part, to look at what everybody else has done and to look at what else has happened with the part. It's kind of, like, looking back on something we talked about earlier, it's kind of what Chris Pine should be looking at right now. He should be looking at what Harrison Ford did right and maybe what Ben Affleck didn't do quite as right. It should be whoever does the James Bond next, look at what Daniel Craig did and try and build off that. I think that was what Heath Ledger did. Of course, Christopher Nolan had a huge influence on that with the design of the character, but he didn't try to do what Cesar Romero had done, and certainly not what Jack Nicholson had done. Although if I've got my facts straight, he did talk to Jack Nicholson about it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And learn what it meant to play the character. And then he just took it all and put his own spin on it. And it's, again, it's kind of like what what I was talking about with The Godfather as well. You can't imitate, and with a character like the Joker, it's very easy to imitate because just act crazy and laugh a lot seems to be what most of what that character has been about. But seeing Heath Ledger bring that extra edge of darkness and violence and unpredictability to him is really what made his the character his own.
He just did such a great job. I really think it is a benchmark performance, and I think it's not only should a lot of the credit go to Heath Ledger, but also just in the writing of, like, you know, how the character was described and stuff. I really think you got to give Nolan some props for his direction too.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, but yeah, just such an excellent performance to put on that list. Such a great recast there. Excellent, excellent choice. I don't know if there's a better one that could have been put on there, but yeah, I am 100% with you there. He was great.
Nice. So. Well, in that case, we'll end on that note and wrap up episode 66 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, September 3rd for episode 67. We'll be discussing Premium Rush, which I'm sure Kristen's itching to see.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It has my Joseph Gordon-Levitt in it.
Kristen's website is alleyesonscreen.com. Do you have anything coming up that people can look forward to?
You know what? I'm hoping to probably Premium Rush will be a review that I'll be putting on there soon after I see that. So that's probably going to be the latest thing that's going to come up.
Very cool. And if people want to find you on Twitter, where can they find you?
They can find me at kgriff111.
There we go. My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes of the show by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry, the iPhone podcasting app, and the iTunes Music Store. They all give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. If you do follow me through the iTunes Music Store, drop me a review. I wouldn't mind getting a few more of those and up the profile of the show, and that'd be much appreciated. Feedback on Bourne, on the fall films that you're looking forward to, or on your favorite moments of recasting can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I am matinee_ca, or Facebook, where it is facebook.com/darkmatinee. Kristen, it has been a long night. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I don't. I really enjoyed being on the show, though. It's something I wanted to come on for a long time, and so I'm very happy to have been on. Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy to have finally had you. Now, I do have one question, though, of something we were talking about before we went on air. Is there going to be a second date?
You know, I think there will be a second date.
That's very good. And when you go on the second date, do thank him from me that you could have cut the first date short to come and be on my podcast.
I will do that, definitely.
There we go. For Kristen, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.